Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 16 years in, the 21st century is an awkward adolescence, about the age of Molly Ringwald's character in Pretty in Pink, director John Hughes' movie about a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who falls for a rich classmate.
Why haven't you called me?
Oh, I got nailed for the stable thing. I guess a groom's horse, it's against club rules.
I called you 3 times and I left messages.
Yeah? Well, I didn't get them. My family, they're irresponsible about that stuff, you know?
That movie is now 30 years old, one of the teen-centric 80s movies adored by people who may now have teenage kids of their own. Kevin Smokler makes the case that movies like Back to the Future, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club, and other big-haired classics represented the first time that teenagers were portrayed as human beings. And though dated by side ponytails and acid-washed jeans, they belong in the American film canon. His new book is called Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. And Kevin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me, Virginia. This is great.
Well, I've seen these YouTube mashups of 80s teen movies. Now, I'm wondering, like, why would they hold a place today for kids who have no idea what it's like to call someone on a rotary phone and have your family not give you the message?
Oh, you know, I think that stuff is quickly overlooked by the fact that the 80s teen movie largely seems to be relatable but not realistic. I think if these movies felt like documentaries of what it was like to be a teen in 1984, they would feel very dated. But instead, they feel like fables and myths about what it was like to be a teen 30 years ago. And consequently, you can graft your own experience if you're a teenager of today on top of that. And of course, all of that has gotten a helping hand from movies like Pitch Perfect, which contains essentially a 20-minute encomium to The Breakfast Club right in the middle of it.
Well, so you hop into the DeLorean in this book and bring us back to what was going on in the 80s. What was it that was making teen movies so successful?
Oh, there were a lot of things, starting most obviously with a generation of directors who, while not teenagers themselves, were interested in telling stories about young people. And that's most obviously John Hughes, but also Amy Heckerling and Martha Coolidge and Cameron Crowe and Savage Steve Holland. Also, you had the biggest boom of teenagers in the workplace since World War II. So that meant a lot of teenagers with disposable income and a lot of teenagers gathering in the places they worked, like shopping malls and record and video stores, and of course movie theaters, as we see in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And we also had, at the exact same time, an explosion of ways to consume popular culture and media, from cable television to video games to VCRs and related home video. It was really the beginning of the teen consumer. I wouldn't say at the beginning. The 60s was more the beginning of the teen consumer. This was the apogee of the teenager as a mass market. And of course, that came with entertainment directed at teenagers.
And it was also the apex or nadir, depending on who you ask, of the suburbs. And locations are a very important thing for you. You kind of lock into why these movies, often placed in a kind of suburban anywhere USA, are not just backdrops, but also kind of a supporting character. Why is location so important?
Well, the obvious answer is this is the last generation of movies about teens before the internet comes along, before the internet and mobile phones sort of upend our very notion of location. And while I would argue that the teen movies that came in the next decade, your Cluelesses and your 10 Things I Hate About You, Clueless is a better movie because of how it uses Los Angeles, and 10 Things is far more interesting because of how it uses Seattle. But I think in those cases, geography is kind of incidental to what makes the movie special. On the other hand, can you imagine Ferris Bueller's Day Off without the German Day Parade in downtown Chicago, or Breaking Away without Bloomington? Part of the testament to the permanence and the endurance of the 80s teen movie seems to be how rooted it is to places that still exist.
Well, we definitely have to talk about John Hughes and Shermer, Illinois. But you raise a great point in here that he was making movies when the cities were these kind of dens of iniquity, you know, a place to escape to. But, you know, not like it wasn't until the 90s that we had Starbucks and yoga studios and loft apartments. The suburbs were safety in some way.
That's certainly how they were portrayed in these movies, at least in the sort of more mainstream John Hughes-powered versions of these movies. The darker, more dystopic versions of these movies, like Over the Edge and Heathers, portrayed the suburbs as kind of a kind of sterile hell, which is not a point of view unique to the 1980s, but one that was used to sort of skew the teen drama and black comedy of those movies. Yeah, the 80s are the height of the suburbs and just before new urbanization begins. You know, in another 5 years, like you said, you have Starbucks and yoga studios and people moving back into the cities. And nowadays you get a movie like Perks of Being a Wallflower, which ends with a triumphant shot of the three main characters driving into Pittsburgh. Set that movie in 1983, they would have been driving out of Pittsburgh as fast as their car could take them.
Well, John Hughes, of course, is one of the people that we remember. And since he died, five, 6 years ago?
Yes.
So many people have been thinking about and paying tribute to him in the years since. But he grew up also in the suburbs, but he grew up in Grosse Pointe, which is, I guess, north of Detroit. But his house was a little smaller than the other people's on the block. So there's this kind of feeling of inferiority. How do you think he was working that out in his movies?
The two movies that John Hughes scripted and didn't direct, Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful, both deal explicitly with class. We see a little bit of that beginning in The Breakfast Club, which he did write and direct as well. So John Hughes grows up a middle-class kid in an upper-middle-class town, and the tensions between kids of different classes and what it meant to not feel to feel judged because of where you came from is certainly part of the drama of his movies. It comes out a lot more in the movies, in the teen movies of this time that are self-consciously set in Los Angeles. So that would be your Valley Girls and your Karate Kids and your the Decline of Western Civilization documentaries, as well as Suburbia. All of those movies deal explicitly with kids on the wrong side of a class divide. I try to argue that has something to do with Los Angeles's attitude towards itself at that time.
Let's play just a clip from The Breakfast Club. Yeah. Here, clearly, Judd Nelson, who's the greaser? I can't remember.
The criminal.
Johnny Bender, I think was his name, is clearly up against something.
Well, I'll just run right out and join the wrestling team. Maybe the prep club, too. Student council.
Nah, they wouldn't take you.
I'm hurt.
You know why guys like you knock everything?
Oh, this should be stunning.
It's because you're afraid.
Oh, God, you Richies are so smart. That's exactly why I'm not heavy in activities.
You're a big coward.
I'm in a math club.
See, you're afraid that they won't take you. You don't belong, so you just have to dump all over it.
Well, wouldn't have anything to do with you activities people being assholes now, would it?
Well, you would know. You don't even know any of us.
So, the Richies.
Did you just say, I'm in the physics club to yourself? That's the next one.
You did, because you've seen it like 55 times.
At least, yeah.
I have not. But it is interesting, you know, you get the Richies, as he said in there. Some conflict. Do you think that's reflective of what was happening across America at that time? This is the Reagan go-go 80s.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think any more or less than now. In fact, I would say economic inequality is probably worse now than it was in the 1980s. I'm not an economist. I don't know the answer to that. I just know it was of concern to John Hughes and frankly many of his contemporaries too, but it is only one theme that runs through the 80s teen movie.
We're speaking with Kevin Smokler. He's a big fan of 80s movies and an author of a new book called Brat Pack America, Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. So, yes, class was a part of the issue there, but there was a real lack of racial diversity in his films. Did that reflect what was happening in suburban America, or was Hughes just using a kind of microscope to represent the wider teen experience?
I don't think the wider teen experience was all that interesting to John Hughes. The genius of John Hughes, and also the difficulty of watching him today, is that he did get at a universal teen experience, but through a very, very small lens, a very small geographic lens with only kids that are largely white and upper middle class. There's a few working class kids in his movies, but largely a white upper middle class generation of young people. I think we can point to that and say that might have been a shortcoming of many of those movies. I also think we can say that those movies pried open the door for a greater, deeper, more compassionate look at youth culture in the United States. And that led naturally towards what happened the next decade with movies like Mi Vida Loca and Boys in the Hood and Set It Off, which are all movies about the youth experience of people of color in this country that are painted with the same degree of sensitivity and depth and compassion as the John Hughes movies of the previous decade.
Well, The Breakfast Club was meant to be taking place in Shermer, Illinois, on one particular Saturday of detention. You mentioned
March 24th, 1984.
You're so good at this.
No, it's funny because that's actually an inside joke. That was the week the movie began principal photography, so that's why they put that in the script.
You mentioned that the movie critic and longtime Chicago resident Roger Ebert called Chicago the teenage Hollywood, but it was actually this fictional suburban town of Shermer, Illinois, that almost universally was understood by teens, even those who had never been to Illinois.
Yeah, I spoke to a bunch of people from this book who were from not the north suburbs of Chicago, people who were from the south suburbs, a different side of Chicago, people who had never even been to Chicago when they saw these movies. And yet somehow this experience spoke to them. Somehow this setting and the drama that happened there spoke to them. I think Shermer has become such a stand-in for the backdrop of the 80s teen movie, the same way Brat Pack, those two words together, now means 80s teen movie. It's so much a part of movie culture now that, for example, in John Hughes's biography, they had to spend all of like page 14 explaining that Shermer doesn't really exist. There was an anecdote I had to cut out of the book where a friend of mine from college decided to take his daughter to see Shermer, which doesn't exist, and he didn't know it. So he put Shermer into his rental car GPS, and he ended up on Shermer Road in Des Plaines looking at a cemetery and a housing development. And
wow.
His daughter was like, so? The fact that we have been contending in pop culture with whether Shermer, Illinois actually exists just tells me how complete a universe that John Hughes created in really only three or four teen movies.
Of course, John Hughes, as you point out, was not the only great director of that time. But
no.
Movie fans from the 80s, they gravitate towards different places where, like, where was the Back to the Future shot? You know, can we go to Ridgemont High? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
why do you think movie fans really gravitate towards these old locations that were just thrown off?
When you go to a movie location, for example, for the 25th anniversary of Back to the Future, they showed it in the parking lot of the Puente Hills Mall, which, of course, is where the DeLorean, you know, hit 88 miles an hour and actually went back to the future, or back to the past in that case. They showed the 25th anniversary there because the location itself has emotional power. When you make a pilgrimage to the location of where your favorite movie was filmed, you are not only collapsing time, i.e. you are going back to the historical moment when you saw that movie and it was made, you're also collapsing memory. You are remembering the first time you saw that movie, and you are stepping into a dream. You are stepping into, for a moment, a beloved movie. And if you love that movie enough to visit its locations, and people don't visit locations of movies they hate or feel lukewarm about, the dreams of that movie are probably yours too. A movie exhibitor I interviewed actually said there are certain kinds of movie fans in the world who, when you say, let's watch 2001 on the Moon, say, sign me up. And there are others that say, oh, it's just a movie, who cares? I think the people who love movies deep down in their heart recognize the emotional power of where movies happen.
Well, I think you are one of the former, is my guess, Kevin Smokler.
Sure am.
You know, you did make pilgrimages to some of these locations, but you also point out the danger of nostalgia. You know, this kind of idea that, things were so much better then. But now I look back at these movies and their characters with the kind of affection that a lot of people don't seem to have for teenagers today. So which movies do you think will define the teenagers of today? And how does that sense of nostalgia just tie into all this?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, there are great teen movies being made today. Dope, Perks of Being a Wallflower, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, the recently released Edge of 17. Like, Sing Street, which I just saw. I mean, there are great teen movies being made today. Which ones will endure throughout the ages? I don't know. I don't think we knew that about The Breakfast Club or Real Genius or Dirty Dancing at the time either. If what you're asking is, will one of these movies be as beloved by not only teenagers but adults? Of course it will. We just don't know what it is yet. Just like we didn't know it was going to be The Karate Kid or Dead Poets Society when those movies came out. But something will. And this may sound like a self-serving argument, but I think one of the reasons for that is the teen movies today are the nieces and nephews and grandnieces and grandnephews of the movies in this book. They have that DNA. They have the DNA of teen movies that have endured for the last 30 years. And so I believe some of them will too.
Well, Kevin, thank you for speaking with us. You've renewed a spark for 80s teen movies for me.
Oh, I sure hope so. That's why I wrote the book in the first place. Thanks for having me.
Kevin Smokler, he's author of the essay collection Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School, and his new book, Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. There's a link to find more information on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.